Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, scumbags. This is the Scummy Mummies podcast with your hosts, Ellie Gibson and Helen Thorne.
Hello and welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. It's me, Helen Thorne.
And it's me, Ellie Gibson.
And today I'm very excited because we have the wonderful Io Akinwoleri.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much. I'm so glad you got my surname right. So many practice. People butcher it. It's amazing. Thank you.
I was so nervous. It was in my mouth. But she had a little practice. I was like, no, don't offer to do it. Have faith in her. Show faith.
And guess what? She pulled through.
Well, that's the podcast done. Thanks so much. Lovely to
My
have
work
you.
Here is done. You do the talking now, people. I've peaked. So, Io, tell us about you. Now, I could introduce you, but I would be here all day.
Yeah,
all
mad,
the
it?
Amazing. You. I mean, you're peaking at the moment, man.
Yeah, it's kind of mad, isn't it? Like, so where do I start? A broadcaster, a bit of a polymath, actually. A broadcaster, run a production company. We also run another business which tries to instill like cultural intelligence into businesses. And then one of my favourite things to say is I'm a world record holder as well.
Are you?
Just dropping
Are
that
you?
One in there, early podcast. Should we start the podcast now? Yes. No. So it's mad. I'm still the only person to have swam across the deepest stretch of ocean in the world, which is 11 miles deep, and it was five miles across.
Did you have armbands?
Are you mad?
I would not do that.
I would love
armbands.
To see Mr. Guinness going, to do this world record, you need armbands. No. It
was I was on a giant
proper,
pink flamingo.
Exactly. doggy paddling across it. No, it was...
That's amazing. How long did that take you?
3.5 hours, roughly.
3.5 hours. Well, let me see your world record for swimming across a big fucking ditch or whatever the fuck it is. I don't know. Oh, I did a bit of swimming for a few hours. Well done. I'm going to David Lloyd later. I'll probably do 4 hours.
Man jumps in water, basically.
I am a Guinness World Record holder.
All right, drop it.
I hold the world record for the longest time spent playing Power Wash Simulator on the PlayStation 5.
Yes!
Guess how long I did that for?
10 hours?
24 hours!
You're joking!
6 minutes and 33 seconds. So you sit here, come at me with your 3.5 hours.
I've done my world record
for literally, what's that, Helen? What's the maths? 5-6 times longer than you.
Well,
admittedly, I didn't have to leave my house.
Eight times. Longer, but that's
about eight times.
I tell you what, your finger's got a workout.
Mike, listen, and that Lara Croft's mansion is clean as a fucking whistle. Let me tell you, there was not a speck.
What we say, Helen? Can you add something to this?
No, I'm choosing to stay right out of it.
No, that's very exciting. Was it nerve wracking? Yeah. Were you like, no, I can do this. I got.
No, it was insane actually. So like a deeper story. Sorry about the pun. to why I did it. So in Britain, like literally. If you're an ethnic minority, you're 3 times less likely to swim compared to white people. It's like just a fact. Like culturally, swimming in the Western world is a very white thing, right? So for me, I was on Blue Peter at the time. I got to the age of 28, realised I'd never learnt to swim. And here we are, you know, the hosts of this show, inspiring young people to push themselves beyond their limits and whatnot. And I realised that, you know, I was genuinely petrified of the water. So, you know, in true Blue Peter style and fashion, I was saying to my producer, you know what? I've been jibbing out of it for so long. Like, I remember when we went to Turkey and my colleagues were swimming across the Bosphorus. They went, "Why can't you swim?" I was like, "I'm just not into it." Threw a massive hissy fit. They were like, "No, it's fine. You can sit on the boat." genuinely, I was shit scared of the water.
Really?
Yeah, it's a real thing. It was a real thing for me. So my boss was like, "Look, no one has ever swum across the deepest stretch of ocean. So if anyone doesn't know, like the Mariana Trench in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I would have to swim 5 miles. But not just that, I'd had 10 weeks to learn to swim prior to that. So I just had to get my shit together and do this world record."
Sorry, we're just picking our jaws off the floor.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's
such a better backstory, to be fair. I wish I could sit and go, historically, of course, white people have not played the ocean. Changing that, and then there's lots of socioeconomic reasons.
How do we readdress that? Yeah. White people need to play more computer games. So what I did was a 24-hour.
Some little heroes wear capes.
You know what I mean? Or wetsuits. But like, you know, it was insane. It was probably one of the greatest things I've ever done in my life. Really, like, and what was most beautiful about it was that you start to learn mentally, and you know this about your marathon running and stuff, how far you can push yourself mentally. And the fear of starting is always the hardest bit. Mm. Once you get into it, the first few weeks are always going to be shit, still going to be tough. And then when you start seeing that progress, you're going, "Oh my God, like this 6 weeks ago, I could barely stand in the shallow end."
Yeah.
And look at me now doing like 25 metres in a swimming pool. And then you start adding it one by one. And if I'm honest, like I had to get it done, because there's nothing better than getting you to do something than have someone shoving a camera in your face going, "You need to get this done." And I also realised actually through doing it, which is so beautiful, how many people in Britain can't swim. Like, I'm talking adults, I'm talking people in their 40s, 50s, they never really learned to swim or afraid of the water. And that, not just ethnic minorities, that stretched across like white people. Could look, I mean, there are millions of people in Britain that genuinely can't swim, which
and why
baffles
is,
me.
Is, if you, like, what are the themes when people say, well, is that a socioeconomic thing? Is it a cultural thing? Or is it all the things?
It's bigger than just one thing. You hit it there. It's a bunch of lots of things. Like, so I grew up in Nigeria, and, you know, as a immigrant family come to Birmingham in 1990, like, you know, my parents weirdly can swim, but it wasn't really anything we did as a family. But also I realized that my mom's fear of the water sort of passed on to the kids. Like, my parents and I live in Florida, never been to the sea. Like, it's hilarious. Florida has some of the best beaches, you know, in the world. My parents have never been, so it, culturally, wasn't something we did. And if you think about it realistically, like, you know, I mean, it's a real cultural thing that British people, if you're middle class or whatever, you manage to go on holiday, Centre Parks or wherever, you know, you go, you lounge around the pool, you lounge on the beach, you go for a little dip and you come back. I mean, I'm not tanning anywhere, so like, I ain't going to the beach. You know, it's just not a cultural thing for us. But even though across Africa, I mean, you can look across the African coast, fishermen, you know, the list goes on. The relationship with water with black people, it goes far back as, you know, the ancient days. But the idea of recreation and swimming wasn't really a thing. I mean, look at the Olympics. When do you ever really see, like, the key African swimmer who's the one creating world records? The African swimmers you do see are usually the small ones. You know, as a culture, globally, we're incredible at so many different sports. Why not swimming? And then you break it down. You look at America, you have this segregation thing with swimming. Pools weren't open to black people in America. White people owned a lot of the pools, and then segregation dropped, and then a lot of the white people create private pools, and the public pools lost funding. So black people ended up not really swimming in America for many of those reasons, socioeconomic as well, and black people didn't have much clout for so many years. South Africa, exactly the same thing. You've got a whole country in South Africa where you've got a small white minority who control the pools, and then you never really created many South African swimmers. So there's this whole, it basically changes globally wherever you go. In Britain, because Britain doesn't like to talk about its past, it's very hard to find that data, but I think there's a real socioeconomic issue attached to it as well. Like, we were just talking when I came, like, you know, there's two pools near me. There's one that's £5 or so. There's another that's £11. And these are two wonderful Lidos. Mm. Open water, open air, sorry. Well heated, really beautiful. But you know, you're a mom taking a family, that's like 15 quid before you've even got in the water. If you want to go to the park, have yourself a little meal and kick the ball around with the kids, that's so much cheaper.
Yeah.
And swimming really in this country is still a thing that you have to do if you've got a bit of cash behind you. And if I'm honest, the swimming audience is very white and middle class for that reason. We're still trying to figure out how to change a lot of those things. But for me, the entry point into swimming is really, really key. Revising how we do it at schools, because, you know, the thing is, there is school swimming, but a school doesn't have to spend that money on swimming. It's not against the law. So if you're a school in a lower economic area, what's more important to you, books, other bits and bobs, or you're going to take this bunch of kids swimming? It's a fund that's there for swimming, but you don't have to spend it on swimming. And there's nothing by the government to say, blah, 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 you need to learn to swim. What really baffled me is that I met this Somalian woman years ago, and we were just talking about swimming, and she's like, I can swim. I was like, okay, you know, there's like a stereotype of black. She's like, yeah, I grew up in Denmark. I was like, all right, tell me more. She's like, so the Danish government have it that if you leave school and you can't swim, there is a special fund in place whereby people can learn to swim for free. And so it means you've got a population of people that are learning to swim, etc. And
Scandinavians.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Everything's better in Denmark. The bacon. The economic equality.
The pastry, the maternity leave.
And the swimming. Oh, the Lego.
Apparently the sperm is excellent. The Danish sperm is the...
Is that the go-to?
Yeah. I mean...
How do you know this?
Because the Danish sperm banks are... I'm not meaning to taste. I mean, like, as in, like...
My mind didn't go to tasting, but thank you.
No, as in, like, the Danish sperm banks are the most popular in the world. That's the most highly sought after
sperm.
Why is that? Because
then you get a Danish baby.
Does everyone want a Danish baby?
The Danish men are very good looking and smart.
Interesting.
And, yeah.
Big hands, obviously.
Yeah. Very good swimmers. Yeah.
It's meant to be the happiest place in the world.
Yeah.
You want a happy baby, happy sperm.
Get it.
Sorry, why? You were saying something very profound.
But I'm down with the sperm thing. Now I'm a virile world record swimmer. FYI, if anyone needs it, just don't tell my girlfriend, I'm good to go. But it is really interesting when you break it down. Like, globally, it's like there are so many different reasons. I can only really focus on Britain and where I feel like local authorities, where I feel like government is lacking. And that's the reality. It's not just ethnic minorities, it's a socioeconomic issue as well. And it just so happens that a lot of ethnic minorities in Britain are in the working class. That's the reality of it. You know, a lot of immigrants in Britain are in the working class. That's the reality. So you've got a twofold issue there. You have to look at the structural issues as well. Like, you know, when I was learning to swim, I'm looking around and I'm asking myself, okay, who is there that would inspire me to want to come to the water in these beautiful pools? 6 a.m. start, I'm there training in Swiss Cottage, which is an amazing bunch of young people. But, you know, if you're a mom with not much money, you haven't got that time to take your kids to the pool. You haven't got that energy. You've got bigger things to think about. So what is there in that place to help people come to the water in that sense? But also, I got my swimming coach badge about 3 years ago, just because I wanted to understand structurally what those barriers are. So I'm a level one swim coach, and I learned to train in London. And this is in South London. And I'm in the pool, and I'm hearing, and bear in mind, there are black kids learning to swim in there. I'm hearing one of my swim coaches go, you know, these black people can't swim. And I just had to hold my mouth a little bit. You went, it's not even worth it. Like, they just don't swim. And this is like 3 years ago. And I'm thinking, so you've already got that bias mentally within an embedded system. And I'm asking myself, actually, let's even go back. At what point within my training to be a swim teacher has anyone spoke about the diversity of Britain? At what point within that coaching have we had that conversation? And that there lies the issue, because you know, you have culturally a lot of women, Muslim women, coming, you know, with a hijab or whatever, into the pool. You have a lot of modesty issues around the pool. We have a lot of body image stuff around the pool. That's one of the things that actually stops a lot of women swimming, is the body image thing, like, and a lot of men as well.
Yeah.
So none of this stuff is spoken about in swim teacher training. Nothing is spoken about. It's like, this is how you teach them to swim, this is how you teach them to float, blah, blah, blah. So I actually created a project. And I call it the Swim Challenge. I wanted to demystify the fact that people of colour can't come to the water. So I got a bunch of people of all different ages, I did it in 10 weeks and I wanted to reshape how you teach people to swim. We need to open it up in a way that's actually interesting and fun. And that's what we did with the swim challenge. I said, look, if we can get these people to swim in 10 weeks, there needs to be some sort of reward at the end of it. And for me, sport is about opening up horizons to people, right? So there's also a correlation between people of various ethnicities never going into the countryside or visiting British heritage sites. So I'm like, well, if how's the reward sound like? If we can actually get you guys to swim, then if you fancy it, maybe some of you will come do the open water swim with me. Honestly, yeah, there was this kid called Kai who'd never left London before. And I was like, and he's a Man United fan. And we go up to Manchester where the Great Southwell Swim's happening. And he's like, this is my favourite tip. I've never left London. Mm. And I'm like, so if you can connect that with sport and give people an arc where they're able to see themselves do sport and there's a need to do that sport, then you've got gold and people see themselves. They see a worthiness in it. Also, you realise that you go to these big open water events and I'm like, there's only like 3 or 4 brown people there doing it. You know, I'm going to do the Great North Swim this year and I almost guarantee I'll be one of maybe 2 out of thousands of people taking that on. So it's about, for me, reshaping those spaces, re-understanding it and trying to bring communities together, really.
Is there like a nod of recognition between you and the other brown person?
All the time. You know the nod. You know the nod. You know the black nod. Yeah, bro. Yeah, what are you doing here? Yeah, I got you. My girlfriend does this thing, like, my girlfriend's Chinese Vietnamese, and like, we're just walking down the street. She's like, do you know that guy? I was like, no, babe, it's the black nod. When I see another black person in a place we don't see many black people, it's like, right, I love you, let's go. Yeah. I don't even need to know your story, just acknowledgement, it's good enough.
Yeah. And are you, do you, what's a nice way to say this? What? Are you an open water wanker?
No.
Are you one of these people insisting?
He nodded.
I'm shaking my head.
Full of algae and like, it's not, you know, it's not real swimming unless there's a risk of botulism.
Do you know, I mean, these like die hard people just don't do it for me, man. Like, I like to keep it fun, same as you. Like, yeah. I just like to keep it fun. Like, it doesn't have to be arduous. If I'm honest, it's those like super like, what's the easiest way of putting this? I can put it lightly. The diehard freaking open waterers that stop
wankers.
People from wankers that stop people from doing it, like, you know, oh, how dare you, you should be wearing this kit, blah blah blah. Look, it's about inclusion, it's about bringing people, it's about opening it up. First and foremost, it's like the freest thing you can do, open water. So understanding the barriers is important, understanding the issues around it is important. But you know, I'm not even asking people to go for long swims, just get in your waist, get a feel of it, understand it, you know, it, you know, it changes your view of Britain. It changes your mind, like. And no, what I try to do with mine is just try and like have some fun with it. If I'm honest, it's really mostly a bunch of middle-aged white women that love open water swimming. Like, that's the reality.
Yeah, that is the reality. And to be fair, like, I have just called them wankers and I've been awful now, but I, you know, don't, as we always say, don't yuck someone's yum. Like, if you're into that, fair play to you. I it's not for me. I don't like being cold. I don't know really why I went to Mount Everest.
We did it for attention, remember?
It's absolutely, and I hear amazing things about it. People say it triggers something in your brain.
It's
supposed to be amazing. I get it. I just don't want to do it. Stop trying to make me do it. And also, can I just say this? Stop turning up for the school run or for the Saturday morning football in your dry robe. All right, we get it.
Oh,
you've all been in a pond.
Dry
well
robe.
Done.
The dry robe.
Just put a jumper.
It's like
on
a badge of honour. Dry
so
robe
expensive.
And a coffee. They are
like,
so coffee.
They're 160 quid.
But then see the socioeconomic thing I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like dry robe. It's like, yeah, you're I don't like these subcultures that are created through something that should be so accessible and free. Mm. It's like an elitism, which I hate. And that's what I hate about sports. Sport is one thing that should not be elite. It's like, yeah, dry robe. I'm like, I have one. I rarely wear it because I feel really self-conscious that I'm one of those wankers. Just,
I mean,
I
would certainly never do the school running my gym kit on my running gear, Helen, would you?
No.
You would never do that, no.
No, I hate wearing leggings. Nobody needs
that
to know about my running.
Oh,
no, go on, don't. So going back to, it'd be great to hear a little bit more about your experiences growing up here.
Yeah, sure. We came to England in 1990. So my family, like, we were kind of travellers, really. Like, so grew up in Nigeria, but we lived in France for a little bit because my dad was studying in France. And we came back to Nigeria. Then we ended up moving to Birmingham, and now my parents live in America, funny enough. I was a middle-class Nigerian kid. Like, my dad was training to be a doctor, my mom's a nurse, had a lovely little bungalow in Nigeria, and, you know, dog, the lot, like, mango tree at the back. It was pretty idyllic, and all our neighbours were middle-class Nigerian people. My mom comes from a very middle-class Nigerian family. Like, my granddad was, like, before he died, he was, like, the leader of the Methodist Church in Nigeria. So you go to my mom's house in Nigeria, it's, like, a massive mansion with, like, I don't know how many bedrooms. They'd have a chapel in the middle of it, and, like, there'd be pictures of my granddad with, like, Pope John Paul in the Vatican and stuff like that. So that's, like, the life we came from. I wouldn't say materially wealthy, but culturally rich, right? And coming to England was like so different because like we came and my dad, after my dad finished his studies, like we obviously applied to stay a bit longer because one of the reasons we left Nigeria as well is that like we got robbed heavily one night and they had us all on our knees, like a bunch of guys ready to like kill our family. Like,
oh my god.
Yeah, no, it's kind of deep actually. And yeah, I've had therapy since. It's great, you know, having to talk about it and actually having to live through that. So I think there was no reason for my dad wanting to take us back, really. It was like, look, you know, my dad's, you know, brains had brought us here. He was like, can we get a better life for our family? As well as, you know, my dad's so bright. He was actually brought over to do some research into the meningitis vaccine in the 90s. So incredible. Because there was a massive epidemic in the 90s. So he came up to do some research. I was hopefully going to take it back to Nigeria, but we obviously decided to stay. So, you know, we came here and, but I guess for us, we had to start again. And I still haven't spoken to my parents about how tough that was, because you come from a really middle-class environment and then you come to Britain and then you're put in a council house. And it just changes the way you view yourself as an individual. But secondly, you see where you're, I guess it's really odd to say this, where you're ranked in British society. We talk about classism in Britain. We talk about the class system in Britain. Like, even in that space, my dad's or my parents' sort of Nigerian, you know, like education, which is a British education really, because Nigeria is a British colony, wasn't taken as seriously over here. We were grateful that my mom's a nurse. So there was a huge shortage of nurses at the time. So she worked in the NHS through and through. And my dad really struggled to get work to the point where he could only work in a petrol station. And, you know, if you look at I think Cambridge has had its first ever black sort of professor ever in its history. Like, my dad was struggling to really break through academia in Britain. And I mean, I don't know what that did for his mental health. We've never really had that conversation, but it was really tough for him. So we had to start again, like from fresh. And some of the houses we were putting in this country were like really, really dark, man. Like, I remember, because it was like four kids at the time, we were putting this house in, you know, a very deprived part of Birmingham, and there was like proper mold on the walls, like dark rot, and that's where they put our family in. And I'm thinking, I was in Nigeria like 4 or 5 years ago, like, and we had like a yard and all this kind of stuff. But in a very strange way, like, it gave me a really interesting insight into Britain and the different ways people permeate this country, right? And who has and who hasn't, but also how little the middle class understand about people within the working class, and how tough things can be, and how oppressed you can be when that is your reality day to day, you know? And for me, it gives me a really good insight into Britain. So yeah, we lived in Birmingham for a while, and I remember my parents sort of buying their first house, saving all their pennies. I think we'd been here for about 10 years, and they finally were like, you know, the middle class ideals drove them to be able to sort of buy a house, saved everything they could. And we bought a house in Birmingham, and my parents, not really knowing the area that well, sort of just bought the house that they thought we could all live in. You know, it's like a 4-bedroom house in probably not the poshest part of Birmingham. It was a sort of upper working class, if that's a way of putting it. It was just verging on middle class, but it wasn't really. Like, a lot of British flags, you know, St. George's flags still on the walls, on the houses, and we didn't really know what that meant. And we bought this house, and the first day we'd moved in, the National Front spray painted our door. They told us to get the hell out. And this was the landscape we grew up in Birmingham, like, you know.
And this is like the 90s.
Yeah,
well.
I mean, yeah. This is coming up to 2000. Like, this, yeah, it's not
Jesus
that long
Christ.
Ago. It's 20 years or so ago. Like, it's not that long ago.
That's not that long ago.
No, and you go, and I didn't know this story until, like, we were a bit older. I'd gone to university and stuff, and my dad was like, oh, yeah, I had to get up in the middle of the night and rub it off, like, just to make sure you guys didn't see it when you got up.
Oh.
But my parents had invested in this house. This is the area we grew up in. And, you know, we were going clubbing, coming back home. I'm like, and look at it back now. My parents just never went to sleep. Like, they wanted us to be like normal kids and try and integrate and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, every time I'd come back home from Clover, my dad would be waiting up. I'd be like, why are you waiting up? Like, go to bed. And they were just afraid for us. Yeah. Like that, you know, they'd put us, you know, out of no fault of their own in this situation, right? Like, and this was the neighborhood. Like, no, we spoke to a few neighbors, but everyone sort of kept themselves to themselves. And I'd always wondered, like, why? And this was the reason. It was like that part of Birmingham, Worley Castle at the time, was like a real hub for the National Front. You know, I went back a few years later and I did documentary when I started doing sort of TV. And this is what really baffled me, is that my parents had managed to save a lot of their shit that came towards our family away from, that shielded us, shielded it away from us as kids. And then I do this documentary and it's seen, and I get all these like emails from people in the neighborhood going, your family had it so hard, you know, it's a shame what happened to your family, blah, blah. And I'm like, so you were watching it happen and none of you, you know, you call yourselves, you know, multicultured, you call yourselves all this kind of stuff, and none of you did anything to help or really safeguard our family. You were just watching, peering through the window, watching it happen. I was like, damn, man, that's not community for me. Like, and but then I look at it. The weird thing about this country sometimes is that, as I said earlier, like the working class are sort of clumped into the same space. And then you have a further sort of interesting mix to that, is that when immigrants come to the UK, they're clumped into the same space as the working class. So you get this fight of privilege. Mm-hmm. This is our country, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, the reason my family's here, let's not forget, is that Nigeria was part of the British Empire for yes. so long. So I'm coming to Britain thinking, all right, yeah, like
you guys came over to
you
my
guys
country.
Came over to my country. Yeah. My country didn't exist pre 1800.
Yeah.
Like it actually didn't exist as a country. It was a British country, and that's what. Why do you speak English to us? Because it's my second language. You know,
because you made people.
My ancestors. Yeah, like you know, it. I actually have no thought of. I can't remember most of my history, but I know all of yours.
Yeah.
So that's the hard thing about it, is that, like, you know, most minority groups are within the British working class, and you already have a disenfranchised group of people who are still trying to navigate how they exist within the British world. And then you have another issue where you've got a lot of potentially entrepreneurial people who've come from abroad. As I said, I'm a Nigerian middle-class man. So mentally, of course my parents want me to go to university. Of course my parents want to buy their first home. Of course they want to do all these things because that's what's afforded to them. Mm. Mentally, that's what they aspire to do. And also, without being rude, I didn't know I was black till I came to Britain, because I was surrounded by black people who were lawyers, doctors, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you just called each other people.
You just called each other people. But yeah. Also, I had examples of people that I could watch on the TV, that I could see day to day, that were doing incredible things. And then I come here and it's like, why are people just limited to music and sport? Like, I don't, and why is it when I'm watching the news, it's that people that look like me are the ones that are mugging people and stuff like that? I mean, you're a Londoner, you know the rhetoric around what was going on in London for so many years, or the British media for so many years around ethnic minorities, and that othering of people is, you know, became really damaging to me. So for me, my career has been about, that's why I did The Swim, that's why I did Blue Peter. I was like the first black guy to ever host Blue Peter. It's about reshaping the way we see people that look like me in media, and actually just normalising the fact that anyone has a seat on this table. Navigating it is where the bigger conversation's happening. How do you permeate different spaces? But visually, when you start having those kind of things, it spawns on actors, it spawns on graphic designers, it spawns on architects, and hopefully that's part of the rhetoric we're trying to do here with all the things that I'm trying to create.
Yeah, it's such a huge challenge to do that as well, because I feel like, yeah, obviously representation is important for all the reasons you've just said, but then on the other sort of side, you've got people like the government, the people in power, stoking these fires and pitting these groups of people against each other, trying to create division, because that serves the people in power.
It's a tough one when you sort of watch it and you sort of see it and you ask yourself, like, of what purpose is that? Because, you know, I guess we're given this idea that we can all do and achieve anything, right? But this is not a meritocracy.
It's such a myth, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a meritocracy. I don't think enough people are given the codes on how to climb or try how to move up in the world. And it's those codes are really key. And those codes are afforded to people who have had private education. Those codes are afforded to people who are lucky to have a good network. I keep saying, like, you're only as liberal or as diverse as your bubble allows you to be. So we can all be in these bubbles thinking, no, you can do it. We can get there. Mm. Because that's probably what your bubble of, you know, network or influence allows you to think. Then you talk to a young man who's grown up in an estate, or a young woman, or a young trans person who's trying to permeate this world, you know, and they're sitting in their offices or whatever, or their places of work, thinking, I don't feel welcome here, man. Like, I don't know how much longer I can last here. Whereas the boss is like, if you work hard, you'll get your raise, blah blah blah. But deep down inside, you're like, nah, man, this isn't for me, man. I'm getting the hell out of here. I'm not sure about this, because whoever is in that position of power has allowed themselves a bubble of influence and created a bubble around them that enforces all their beliefs. So it's very hard to then look at the starters and the juniors and go, yeah, you know, that the reason they're not working is because they're not working hard enough. And you're like, no, the reason they might not be working hard enough is because the culture here is a bit, you know, toxic. Also, they're looking around thinking, who can I connect with here? Like, you know, who understands my story? Who understands my vibe? Like, that's part of the job. That's part of the issue. So, you know, on the flip side, one thing we try and do with our business, Cultural Intelligence, Cultural Agility Sessions, is that we try and reshape workplace culture. Because it's up to the leaders to reshape workplace culture. It's up to the leaders to set the culture or create the culture. And actually, unless the leader or the CEO or whatever really understands themselves properly, understands their privilege, how they permeate the world, all those kind of things, then you won't have an office that has that. Let me tell you something. Like, I came into the BBC so many years ago, in 2006, right, on a diversity scheme. And here we are. 20-odd years later.
Sitting in Helen's kitchen.
Sitting in Helen's kitchen.
How far
talking.
Have you come?
How far have we come in 20 years? Still feels at the epicentre, at the forefront of everything we're talking about. So it's really tricky, because what's happened is a lot of people that have the money for diversity are upper middle class people. So unless they've really done that work themselves, unless they've really understood their history, unless they've really understood how they permeate the world and what that privilege looks like, then those schemes are short-lived. They're well-meaning, but they're not really going to make the impact you really want them to make. But also, if you say, just because you're an advocate for women's rights doesn't mean you're not culturally biased in the people you bring into those spaces, right? So if you say, like, yeah, I'm a big feminist, advocate for women's rights, and then you look at your circle and all your leader friends are all white, then you love women's rights, but you're talking about white women's rights, realistically. And, you know, there was something put up yesterday on my LinkedIn, and it was by a CEO of a big channel, and they were like, women, we've come so far. And it was like the head of women in advertising, and none of them look like me. And I'm like, but you've not really addressed the fact that you're talking about women that look like yourself.
Yeah. But I tell you, I bet all those people in that photograph are amazing open water swimmers. Let's not discount that.
I'm sure it's part of their daily routine. Yeah. No, it's really interesting. Can I say, I think I'll convert you. You just need to come swimming with me. I'll make sure you get into that. Like, I've got my girlfriend.
Are you
going
to pay for the £11? Thank you very much.
No, we're going to the ponds, man.
Oh, we're going to the ponds.
Pamstead Ponds. That's free. We can go there.
Yeah, but you have to leave Southeast. Why would you do that?
This is also very true. This is very true.
Keston Ponds, actually. That's not too far.
Did people swim in that one?
I used to when I was a child. But again, when I was a child in the 80s, like, entertainment was a different thing.
Do you know what I mean? There was lots to do. Yeah. It felt like anything was entertaining. I've also got this thing about swimming in ponds and sharing it with ducks and stuff. I'm not into
that. What about the serpentine? Can you...
No. They have an annual swim there, like, as the serpentine.
Wait a minute. Do you want
thing.
To bring back segregated water, but for ducks? Because that's
I mean, my cultural intelligence for ducks needs to be sort of brought back in.
Let's workshop it.
Yeah, but I mean...
Have you practiced quacking?
Just say a quick quack and they sort of run around, give them a few instructions, and they sort of dissipate and go, yeah, totally
you're
allowed.
They just give you the nod.
Look, I'm coming into their world. It's good to really build that cultural intelligence up, but movement for the body is really, really key. It's just really important. But in terms of mood changing as well, like, I feel like so many of us deal with so much, and there's something about movement and the body that kind of raises some sort of endorphins, or going out and seeing stuff. Nature is really important to me, and even just a walk for 10, 15 minutes, if you're close enough to a park, is really, really interesting, just to sit, look, understand. understand, listen to the birds, all that kind of stuff. It's less about the working out, but more about the experience for me. Mm. And that's what I love. And that's why I love the open water swimming. It's more about the experience than actually the swim itself. I love it. Like just laying back and like looking up and seeing this. I love it, man. It's really nice.
Oh, I'm going to get a world record.
How long can I lie on my back? My lazy ass in a pool in you know, in the open sea, honestly.
Amazing.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Well, look, there we go. It's time now, of course, for the Scummy Mummy Confessions. Who wants to go first, team?
You go first, Helen.
All right. I've been dating a Spanish man.
Hey, hey!
Oi, oi!
Teaching you a bit of a Espanole?
Yes, exactly right.
Ole, ole.
Anyway.
Ole, so, you're so British. Ole, ole, mate.
That's all the Spanish I know.
Is that what you said on your first date?
Yeah.
Ole, ole, yeah. Son.
Oh, ole, ole. Show me your chorizo. Oh, got any paella? Yeah, lovely.
Keep going.
So I've been doing my Duolingo every day.
Nice.
Everybody knows because it's logged into our joint email account. And I was practicing some of my Spanish on my lovely fella on the weekend. And he said, Helen, just say things as you would say them. I was like, yo quiero un hamburguesa. Ooh. And he said, you don't say, how would you say hamburger? I was like, hamburger. He said, just say hamburguesa. I was like, oh yeah. So I've been speaking like they
do the accent. You do the accent.
I sounded like an Italian accent. I know. That's a fucking Mario.
And he said,
it's a me, Helen.
He was so sweet. And he said, when I go home to take you home to meet my family, you know,
don't speak.
They're going to worry about you if you speak like that.
This is the moment the whole family just speaks English to you.
I'm trying my Spanish.
It's hard, man, but like it will come. It will come.
He's like,
come.
Yeah, keep going.
And also, kudos.
Yeah, trying. Anyway, there's some scummy and there's some. Anyway, there I am. You go now, Aya. Come on.
Oh, do you know? I've obviously painted this like really interesting picture of myself, but I'm also a complete klutz, man. Like I genuinely, I do some really dumb stuff. Now I remember like a few years ago, I was in LA. I was trying to like have some meetings, all this kind of stuff, and I was single at the time, and obviously like on Tinder or whatnot. And I remember going to this meeting, and genuinely like it was the weirdest meeting ever. I was trying to connect with like this director and all this kind of stuff, and I walked into the office and she was there just sitting by herself with a dog. I was just like, okay, this is like, you're either a Bond villain or this is like the weirdest meeting. She's like, come in, shut the door. I was like, okay, this is interesting. So she sort of sat me down in a chair in the far corner, and she sort of comes to sort of sit next to me. She's like, hi, how are you doing? So we talk about why I'm in LA, who I'm connecting with, all this kind of stuff. And she went, you know, there's not many beautiful English men that come into LA. I was like, oh, okay. Okay, this is going interesting. I'm not here for that, but let's keep talking. And then the dog sort of toodles along to me and she goes, oh, he doesn't just lick anyone. You know? Me, this is completely going the other way. So I was just like, right, just like, yeah, if you want to hang out, like, sure, like, let's hang out, like, we can meet before you go back, blah blah blah. And I'm like, I can't come back here, man, fuck me. Like, and I had someone who was looking after me, like an agent at the time, who was looking after me in LA. So I get back home and I got an email from her, says, how did the meeting with blah 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 go? I was like, look, yeah, like, welcome to Hollywood, .. This is what it's all about. This is insane. This is what she did. I kind of found it a bit weird, kind of freaky. But hey, I guess this is what you got to do to get a job in Hollywood. Send. I got an email back from the director saying, I don't think you should have sent that to me. Do you know what had happened? In my ADHD head, I'd opened up an email just to be polite and be like, do you know what, don't need to connect, all good, really
lovely
nice to meet you. But
really
I had it in my head that I need to email my agent, and I literally said it because I'd seen it in my inbox on the side.
Oh, no.
I'd read it and I was just like, oh fuck.
And that's why you're not the new Thor.
See you later, baby. Here today, gone tomorrow. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is my rather embarrassing story.
Oh.
But hey, we live and learn.
Is that the dream, though, Hollywood? Is that the ultimate IO?
No, I don't know. I don't know what the dream looks like. Do you know what? I'm like yourselves. I don't believe you can be. You'd have to be just one thing.
Yeah.
I believe you can be anything.
Mm.
And I just want to keep so many options open. Like, obviously, I'm a TV presenter. I do sport. You know, I did the Winter Olympics. I did the Commonwealth Games. I do a lot of football now and have made that transition from, you know, kids' TV to, I guess, quote-unquote adult TV. But for me, like, it's limitless for me. I realise that I'm an intelligent guy. I'm well-travelled. I know quite a few people. And actually, before I die, I want to taste a lot of things. So why not? You know? So if it's Hollywood, it's Hollywood. If it's not, it's not. And the reason the Hollywood came is because my parents live in the States, so, and they're getting older, so I want to be a bit closer to them. And I was just trying to figure out how I get work out there, really, and just try and understand the landscape. If I'm honest, it's tricky. I don't know if it's for me. I like Europe. I want to go elsewhere,
yeah.
You know, like, but if I can dip my toe in there, yeah, who knows?
That's but if they're living in Florida, you can always pop a Mickey costume on. I'm guessing your criminal records checked.
I'm pretty good so far. Just ask that director, right? Ask the director. What about you? What you got?
Yesterday we had some friends round for lunch.
Uh-huh.
Very nice. My little son Joe, he wanted to make a chocolate cake. And I was like, okay, fine, because that means we can do an activity that feels worthy without leaving the house, which is something I always really enjoy.
Yeah.
And so we made this chocolate cake, and then the friends were around, and I was like, oh, he made it himself. I'm so proud of him. And then I looked over, and we had a cover on it, and he'd lifted up the cover, and he was just licking the side of the chocolate cake.
Oh my
we were about to serve
oh
them
my god
dessert.
Oh my
so,
god
I'm so sorry.
What did you do?
Just laughed at gave him that bit. I was licking it like a cat with a tub
oh
of butter
god.
Just like eh.
Oh my god,
it was
well trained.
He plays by his own rules, that child. What can I say? And then he did a wee in the garden, which is another
that's
new
really
thing.
Nice.
Feral. Sounds feral. I love that.
Pretty
Let
feral.
Him do what he needs to do.
Yeah.
If he feels safe, if he feels safe around you and allowed to do that.
It's really about the continuation of the brand, IO, for us at this point. 10 years, you know, it's about sustainability. The long tail.
Yeah.
There we go.
Everything is content.
Time for some tedious admin. Mm. We're on tour. We're always on tour. If you go to scummymummies.com, you can see where we're on tour. We're going to Birmingham, actually.
That's my ends.
What's your favourite curry house in Birmingham?
Oh, it's actually the Balti Triangle called Abdul's. Insane. If you go Balti Triangle, it is
Balti
the
Triangle,
one. Yeah.
Abdul's. All right, I'm going to write that down.
Oh, yeah, we're going up and down the country.
We're going to Cambridge,
Bath. We're going to
Leamington Spa, Corby, Harrogate, Leatherhead, Middlesbrough, Chelmsford, Cambridge, if we've said that one. Banbury, Worthing, Barnsley, Bath, Stroud. Have we announced Catford yet? We haven't announced
no!
it.
No! But we will see.
We will.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. Anyway, you get the idea. What about you, Io? Where can people find you and follow your things?
Socials. Io Akin Mulere on social media. Follow me. Come say hello. And obviously on all social media networks as well. Like, I'm just getting ready to have a nice holiday. We've got quite a couple of productions coming out for our production company, fingers crossed. Some just waiting to be greenlit. It's looking like a really interesting documentary. Going back to Nigeria from my side anyway, so we'll see.
Awesome.
I think that's it, Helen.
Yeah. I think so. You've been a fucking delight.
Oh, thank you so, thanks so much. For having
me. No, it's brilliant. And,
it's a joy.
And watch this space.
Yeah, yeah. Let's keep going, mum. Let's keep going. Let's see what happens this time next year. It should be quite fascinating.
And next time you come on the podcast, maybe you'll have a second world record. Who knows?
No, man. I'm done with world records now.
Sure, you are.
Leave it to you.
Leave it to
you. Leave it to the professionals.
Got to go, actually. I've got to go practice. Practice my swimming. I'm going to swim the deepest.
Yes.
Yeah.
In your dry robe.
Yeah. I'm a middle aged white woman. Hey.
Don't get changing.
Do? Just be you.
Until next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye bye.
My other Scummy Mummy's confession is that before you arrived, I put the dirty dishes in my oven. Don't open the oven.
Hey, you've had a busy morning. Go on. Is it in there? Don't do it.
No,
is it in there?
No,
is it?
No, just it's just some dirty. Don't worry. Just leave it. Don't look. I just used like 18 pots last night, so I got through most of it, and then you were just about to arrive. I was like,
Do you know what? I don't judge, man. You do you.
All right.
I mean, externally.
We're in a space of sharing. In a space of sharing.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow-up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.